Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with filmmaker Jeremy Larder on Who's Your Father? And one half of the Water Brothers, Alex Mifflin. That's all coming up on Endeavors. Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. It's 5 days until I fly back to the UK. Hard to believe I've already spent 2.5 weeks here back home on Canadian soil. And like I said, come the new year, I don't quite know what the future holds for me. But I'm sure I will get there in due time. And speaking of the future, my first guest is part of a team that is looking at the future of our planet through the lens of water. He is Alex Mifflin, and together with his brother, they are one half of the documentary filmmaking team, The Water Brothers. And The Water Brothers is now in its fifth season on TVO in Ontario, and as well as the episodes can be streamed off of TVO's YouTube channel as well. And, you know, this season they look at everything from, you know, peat bog and the energy that peat land can create. They talk about microplastics. They talk about how this one lady found the world's oldest water, this pocket of water that had been untouched, they say, for a couple billion years. So it's a really interesting look about water and just how little we know about it. And also how Indigenous peoples and Indigenous culture and their understanding of the land, how important it is to include them in whatever dialogue we are having about water and about the environment. So this is my conversation with Alex Mifflin. Alex Mifflin, one half of the Water Brothers. Hello, how are we doing today?
Doing great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So the Water Brothers is in season 5 now, I do believe. But take us back to the beginning. Do you remember what set you on this journey of wanting to document water and all its sort of uses and factors?
The journey to start the Water Brothers began soon after my brother Tyler and I graduated from university, and we're both working in film and really just wanted to go out on our own, and we had lots of ideas to make documentaries about wildlife. I think we definitely had some dreams. We're both really just fascinated with the natural world and animals and wildlife. But then also, you know, just from our age range, it wasn't just like we want to go take pretty pictures of animals. Like, the world's biodiversity is in crisis, and we wanted our work, whatever it was going to be, to have an impact, to help make a difference, you know, raise awareness and create change to protect the wild places and the wildlife that we fell in love with. So But Water Brothers kind of evolved out of our desire to make, you know, whether it was film or TV or any type of content that would make a difference. And all the episodes, or not episodes, but all the subject matters that we talked about, all the ideas for films, you know, all came back to water. It was always about our oceans and fresh water, and that was just such a common thread. And we were just amazed, like, you know, water's the most important thing on earth, yet like, why isn't there like a ton of content about water? We were really surprised, actually. Lots of people talking about some of these issues, but not necessarily trying to connect it all through water, because water is what connects us all on this planet to all living things. So that's really where it came from. Just, you know, we just had this idea to create a show all about water, about freshwater and ocean, you know, conservation issues, and go out on our own. And we kind of just had this like run and gun style, just the two of us. And we really, TVO was just really loved with this little clip we put together, kind of like a pilot. It was like a 10, 15-minute little video we shopped around, and TVO loved it just because, you know, we were two young guys, hopefully could, you know, raise awareness with youth. And TVO has such good programming for kids and adults. And I think for them, they kind of saw us as this bridge, like, oh, we're young adults. We could, we can fit this niche in our audience that we haven't quite fulfilled. And I think that's where our relationship with TVO was really great. And of course, they support a lot of independent filmmakers. And yeah, we were two young guys with the dream, and really lucky to have their support and, you know, be here all this time later, you know, 5 seasons later. I think that's that we're really fortunate to have this opportunity to tell all these stories and to be doing it for so long.
I mean, it is striking when you think about just how little of, you know, how little about water and the oceans we actually know. I'm curious, this is your fifth season now. How much greater would you say your knowledge and awareness is now versus when you first started?
Well, I mean, obviously, I've learned a lot over all this time. Yeah, I think that one of the coolest parts about this opportunity to do the Water Brothers has just been getting to meet so many incredible scientists, you know, indigenous leaders, you know, just everyday citizens who are dedicated, you know, whether it's through activism or, you know, teachers. Like, there's just so many different people we've gotten to meet who really inspire us. So that's been one of the biggest treats of it, you know, and to learn from them. But yeah, in terms of what we've learned, I mean, I think we knew from the very beginning how important water was. Everything we've learned has just emphasized a lot of that. We've learned a lot of new things with each episode. But I think overall, one of the encouraging things is to see that, you know, from the very first episode being released in 2012, to today, I think that generally the public is much more aware. That's something that excites me more than, say, even more than what, you know, my brother and I have learned on this journey. It's seeing that, like, now, like, you can go to a news site and there's way more stories and content on there about environmental issues than there was 10 years ago. It's definitely not just because of the Water Brothers, but it's just there's it's because of we're just one small little part, I think, of this change we're seeing around the world of people becoming more aware and engaged and wanting to know more and seeking out content that can help, you know, encourage them to make change and be part of that change. So that's been really exciting, is to just see, like, media, everyday citizens just becoming more aware and engaged in these issues. And, you know, a lot of these stories used to be, you know, midway through the newspaper. Now they're like front page news. They're not afraid to make stories about climate change or overfishing or countless other environmental issues, like the front page news. Like, I think in the past there was maybe some fear from media about, like, oh, it's too doom and gloom, or some people don't believe that. I think, you know, the evidence part is clear. Now we're at the stage where it's like, what do we do about it? And that's what the Water Brothers really has always been as well, is we didn't want to just be doom and gloom. Like, every episode is really about solutions. You know, we spend the first 5, 10 minutes kind of like laying out the problem, but the second half of every episode we've ever done is about solutions and reasons to be hopeful, and what people can do, what governments can do, what companies and industry can do as well.
What does conservation mean to you?
Well, I mean, in a way, it's like conservation. The word can be like, oh, keeping things the same, or like slowing change. But I think with for conservation, to me nowadays, is like there's this term rewilding that is being talked about more and more. So conservation is not just about like let's protect, the few wetlands we have left, or let's protect the few wild places we have left. It's how do we create more wild places? How do we rewild the landscape? How do we, make, say, agriculture more sustainable, but then also take degraded lands and turn them back into wild places? How do we take our urban spaces and integrate, wetlands and forests and wild places into them? How do we, ensure that places are actually protected?
Well, and one of sort of the ecosystems that you talk about is peatlands and sort of peat bog. And I think that's sort of a term that a lot of us have heard of, but we may not be fully clear on what it is. Like, is it a swamp? Is it a marsh? Is it this? How would you describe what peatland is?
Well, a peatland is a type of wetland, and it's defined by the depth of its soils and the really slow degrading organic matter within them because of the low oxygen condition. So the soil, all the plant material just takes a really long time to degrade, and so that organic matter builds up in these really thick mats of dense like soil and plant material. And they're incredible carbon storehouses, because in other types of soils, different types of bacteria and organisms will break materials down, and that carbon will be returned to the atmosphere. Whereas in peatlands, the carbon gets stored underground. That's a big part of that story we're trying to tell with that. Some people might be familiar with peat, from things like the old peat bogs of Europe, where there's lots of old like horror stories and myths surrounding peat bogs. People might like peat bogs because they like to drink whiskey or scotch that's made from peat. And humans have a really, really fascinating history with peatlands, which I won't really get into, but it's there's some there's that's we have this interesting relationship to peatlands historically. But as far as the episode today, it's more about the story we're telling today is about really about the future of peatlands. They've been a lot of them have been degraded, but here in Canada, we're lucky to have some, up to almost 25% of the world's peatlands. And in Ontario, we have the second biggest like peatland complex, peatland ecosystem in the world, the Hudson and James Bay Lowlands in Northern Ontario. And so we really wanted to wake the people of Canada up, and people of Ontario specifically, to this treasure we have up far north. It is far away from where most of us live, but it's probably one of the most globally influential ecosystems on Earth. And biodiversity hotspot. We saw so much incredible stuff up there. But it really the story with peatlands we're telling is how it's a storehouse for water, and how that water, that soggy landscape, helps store carbon, 5 times as much carbon per, say, square kilometer in a peatland than carbon that's stored in the Amazon rainforest, for example, which we often think about as like a globally significant carbon storehouse. And it is, but it's like, hey, folks, we have something even more powerful when it comes to carbon right in our own backyards, and we're not always doing the best job of protecting it. And we need to be aware of this treasure that we have and treat it like the treasure it is.
Well, that's featured in your episode Breathing Lands, and I really love the title of that. Do you think sometimes we either underestimate or don't think about just how much the land we're walking on is living?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually kind of we look at that same concept as well in another one of our episodes, Save Our Soils, because it's like whether it's the peat or just any soil you walk on, soils and what's beneath our feet is often disregarded. We don't think of that as a living, breathing thing. You know, soil is just incredibly rich in biodiversity, and you know, just a handful of soil, like we say in the episode, there's more organisms than there are people on the planet. So like if you pick up like a big clump of healthy soil in your hands, you'll be holding like 7 billion organisms. And so we often just think of it as like it's dirt, it's dead, there's nothing in there, you know, other than worms and a few bugs, but it's full of life if we can maintain its health. So that's definitely a big theme of the season, especially for those two episodes, is these ecosystems that we don't appreciate, and we need to think differently about, especially in this era of climate change and looking for as many solutions to climate change as we can.
You also in episodes you talk about one thing that's actually been in the news a lot recently is this idea of forever chemicals, which I think people sort of vaguely know, but you know might not know, but they're present in everything like cosmetics and things like that. How would you describe what forever chemicals are and how toxic they can be when talking about climate change?
Well, the forever chemicals, it's the connection to climate change is not is not really something that we explore there. It's not really a story about climate change. Forever chemicals, they refer to this group of chemicals known as PFAS, perfluoroalkyl substances. And there's thousands of these PFAS chemicals that have been invented. They're not a naturally occurring chemical, like other types of toxic chemicals that we use, like these things have been created in a lab, and they're actually the strongest bond that's ever been created, that humans have ever created. So it's a high, like hydrogen, sorry, fluorine carbon bond, and it doesn't break down. So that's why it's used in all these different products, is because we basically created this chemical that if you apply it to anything, it creates like an unbreakable bond, a surface that, say, water, oil, you know, just flows right off of. It's the reason why your Gore-Tex jacket, water just wicks right off of it, or your rain jacket, water just falls right off of it. It's the reason why your nonstick pan is nonstick. It's the reason why waterproof makeup is waterproof. So it's kind of this amazing chemical. It does like a group of chemicals. It does all these amazing things that we use on a daily basis. But you know, since they were invented, you know, 70 years ago, they've just been increasingly used in more and more and more products, without, you know, the public being made aware of how long they last and how toxic they really are. So one of the big issues with this is that the companies that invented these chemicals and then or figured out ways to put them in everything, they knew how dangerous these chemicals were and didn't tell anyone. They covered it up, akin to how, you know, the oil and gas companies knew about climate change 50 years ago
Right.
and said nothing, and then openly, you know, lied about it, you know, to Congress and to the public. It's a similar situation with that, and we're only really finding out in the last sort of decade just how dangerous these chemicals are. And because that bond is so strong, nothing in nature breaks it down. So even though we might use small amounts in certain products, it's you know, everything that's been created is still out there. And so over time, they're just building up and building up. And so, you know, we know in high quantities they're very toxic to humans and basically any living thing, because the humans that worked at these factories, there's a long, you know, history of evidence of people that have worked at these factories where they manufacture PFAS, of people getting extremely sick and dying and developing all sorts of cancers. There's a film called Dark Waters, which, you know, in our episode, we speak to the lawyer Rob Ballot, who, you know, that film is based upon, like his story and the families he worked with to uncover this massive cover-up that happened. So yeah, our episode is just kind of investigating the story of PFAS from perspective of water, how it's impacting our water, how it's building up in our water, how it's building up in our bodies. You know, all of us have PFAS in our bloodstreams now, and yes, it might be a small amount, but if we're still using them in countless products, and more, uses for them are being invented every year, what's that going to do to our bodies over the long term as these small trace amounts build up into less trace amounts and less small amounts? So yeah, there's a lot of reason to be concerned, and a lot of reason why we need our government to take a stronger stance on regulating these chemicals, because this is not something that they're used in so many products and they're not labeled. And it's very difficult for us to know how or when we're being exposed to them.
You do a great job of including a lot of indigenous leaders and indigenous activists, in whatever topic you're talking about. And they've always it strikes me that they've always that community has always been leaders when it comes to sort of environmental awareness and protection of the earth. Is it just because you think they've lived on the land for far longer than any of us, so they have a better idea of the long-term effects that humans can have? Why is it important to include that, the indigenous community in whatever sort of laws we make?
Yeah, well, indigenous knowledge is so incredibly valuable and has been disregarded for so long, and we all suffer because of it. There's so much we can learn from indigenous communities all over the world, and that's always been a big mission of ours through the Water Brothers, is to just give this platform to people and voices that don't always have the platform they need to share their, important knowledge. And I think that, at the end of the day, we're all humans. I think we all used to be a lot more connected to our lands and waters at some point in human history. But, as we've, especially nowadays, where we're completely disconnected from nature, most of us, we've lost a lot of those abilities, and that knowledge. And so it's so critical that we listen to indigenous communities when they say, this is an area that needs to be protected. And I think that even like, it is just a, in many ways, just a factor of, yeah, being out on the land, being out on the water more time. Like, if you're still relying on, traditional like resources, if you're still hunting and fishing all the time, yeah, you're going to know which day of the year this particular animal comes and leaves. You're going to know, which part of this huge landscape, say in Northern Ontario, where the caribou go. And so if you're there, if you're like in government and you're working with scientists who might use things like tracking the animals or different methods, to keep track or figure out where they go, it's like, well, there's local communities who already know where they go, and they know exact time of year, because it's a life and death scenario for them in some cases to know where certain animals are, or how the landscape changes over the course of a year, or the course of decades, or being able to know how things have actually changed, rather than just, digging up a core like a scientist and then trying to figure it out with like carbon dating or some other thing. So I think there's so much value to be gained from, integrating traditional knowledge with, Western science methods. I think there's so much that can be learned from both perspectives. And I think that, yeah, there's a number of our episodes over the years where we've tried to highlight those ways that learning can happen, and or already is happening.
I think Canada has more lakes than any other country in the world. Do we underestimate just how varied this country's landscape and ecosystem is because it's so big?
Yeah, I think well, at least when it comes to water, we certainly, the because we have so much fresh water, I think it has caused us to take water for granted. We have all these water resources. We have abundant clean water resources. Yet, Canada is probably top five, I believe, in terms of like water use per capita, water waste per capita, plastic pollution. Like, we do not rate well on a global standpoint on so many issues related to water and water use. So And it's just one of those things that you have so much of it, so you just don't have that sort of mindset of saving water, compared to people that live in much more, water scarce communities or regions of the world. So yeah, I think that's something we actually talk a lot about, when we do presentations. Like we've done hundreds and hundreds of speaking events at like conferences and groups of like different levels of government, at schools, lots of schools over the years. And that's something we always try to talk about, is that it's changing that mindset and this myth of abundance, that because we have so much, we like th think we have so much in Canada, we don't actually have to worry about it, or think about water conservation in the same ways that most other countries on Earth do, when in reality, like, we actually are just as vulnerable as any other country. One, because of climate change and how it's changing our water resources so quickly, because we're a northern country and because a lot of our lakes freeze over the winter, they're changing really rapidly. Our lakes are suddenly that we all thought would be just clean and good forever, a lot of them are being much more susceptible, becoming much more susceptible to algae blooms. And so, like, there's more time of the year where our lakes are not frozen and are warming up faster, and then that can give rise to these big blooms of algae. Because we're pumping so many nutrients into our waterways, which is a whole different story. But yeah, these, just to give you a sense of just, we're, because we have so much, doesn't protect us really from anything. Because at the end of the day, most Canadians live on a narrow strip of the country and the furthest southern part of the country. So the actual amount of water resources that like we use, that we get out of our taps, like that's not like the whole country. It's not like your tap is connected to all these clean water sources way up north. No, we're all sharing, using, and polluting a much smaller fraction of our total water resources. And this is some of the things that we are just always trying to get across to Canadians, is that we need to think differently and break that mindset if we're going to overcome a lot of these challenges we face here at home.
And I just want to touch on, because one of the episodes is called "The World's Oldest Water," and that fascinates me. What can you tell us about what actually that means?
So there's this incredible scientist at the University of Toronto, Dr. Barbara Sherwood Lawler, and she studies, well, she studies a lot of different things when it comes to water. But about 10 years ago, she made a discovery in the depths of a mine just outside of Timmins, Ontario, a sample of water that was, over 2 billion years old and had an average age. So the average age of all the water in the samples they were collecting was over 1 billion years, some of it over 2 billion years. So this water had been trapped, 3 kilometers plus deep, beneath the surface, in Canadian Shield, had been locked away. So it had not touched anything else. It just imagine it's like a pocket of water in a rock, in solid bedrock, that had not integrated with any other water or the atmosphere for, billions of years. And this, it's just a fascinating discovery. Like, wow, like water that's been trapped away for 2 billion years. But what she's really interested in is to figure out, could anything be living in that water? And if it is alive, like, what types of organisms are there? Because then what that could lead to is that as we go to Mars and go to Europa and these different moons in the solar system that we know contain water, if these conditions can exist on Earth where we have water locked away for billions of years, and there's organisms that are living in that water, very simple organisms, but still, living things, would it not be possible that, 2, 3 kilometers beneath the surface of Mars, there is water that's been locked away since Mars had surface water? And could that be, contain life on Mars? And I think there's a lot of evidence, to suggest that, that could be the most likely type of organism we find first when we go to these other places in the solar system with water, is that we'll have to dig down. And that could be the place where we find, the first alien life forms we discover might not be the ones, you see, on TV and in movies. There might just be a little simple single-celled organism that looks like the ones that we find in the depths of these mines in Ontario. And what's also exciting about their work is that what they're finding is that this water isn't just like unique to Ontario. Basically, if you go into this type, like types of bedrock, billion-year-old bedrock in different parts of the world, South Africa is another place where they do some work. They're finding water down there that is very similar. So it's just cool to have this old water, but I think what we can learn from that water is even more exciting when we think bigger about life beyond Earth.
I think there are six episodes this season. In the course of filming it, was there a favorite moment, or maybe just one day, or one kind of thing that really stuck out to you, that it turned out really great on camera, or maybe you were awestruck while you were filming it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing that sticks us out to us the most for this season would be for our episode, The Breathing Lands, where we spent a lot of time up on the shores of Hudson and James Bay. And we went back there a couple times at different times, like over the years that like two years we were filming. We were on the shores of Hudson Bay near the mouth of the Wenisk River. And on our second morning on the coast, we woke up and our camp was surrounded by thousands of caribou. Like, and we didn't actually even go there necessarily to film caribou. We were there to film on that trip. Beluga whales was our goal because that's like kind of when we were there in July. It was the best. It's the best time of year to see belugas. Because the caribou up on the coast is migratory, so you don't know when or where.
Right.
Like they could be anywhere between Manitoba and Quebec and Ontario, so it's this huge area. And yeah, we just like lucked out by just waking up, and it's just the animals were right there. We literally didn't even have to leave camp. We just threw our drone up, and we got, I think, some of the best shots of the entire season. So yeah, I think that was one of not just like the coolest parts of this season, but I think that was one of the luckiest days of filming we've ever had, where you just see something totally unexpected and it's like right there. We didn't have to like spend all day searching for this moment. So that was really cool.
Is there one, I don't know, met thing or message or idea that you want audiences who watch this to take away from the program?
Well, I just hope that people who watch the show just gain a new appreciation for our blue planet. I hope people take away that, how we're connected to our water. It might be a challenge being faced on the other side of the world, but we are connected to it through water. And just that by treating water better, our fresh water and our oceans, we can solve so many of the big challenges we face in the world today. Whether it's alleviating poverty or improving access to education for young women in the developing world, like clean providing access to clean water and sanitation is like step one for a lot of these huge challenges we face. Just health. Millions of people die from easily treatable diseases that just come from drinking dirty water. Solving climate change can't be done without conserving our oceans and our freshwater resources. It's just really the biggest challenges we face in the world today are all connected to through water. And if we start looking at, there's so many different problems we face in the world today, but if we just like focus on treating our freshwater and oceans better, a lot of these issues will start solving themselves. Like that there is like kind of one singular focus we can look on or look at and look to that will just make our world such a better place to live for generations to come.
Well, the series is The Water Brothers, and the fifth season premiered on TVO and TVO.org across Canada on November 2nd. And I believe they can also find the episodes on YouTube through TVO's YouTube channel. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's probably the easiest way for people to watch. But if you want to watch on TV, yeah, all the broadcast dates are up there on the TVO website as well.
Perfect. Well, it's a great series, and I encourage everyone to check it out. That is The Water Brothers. Alex, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dan.
All
Take
righty,
care.
cheers. Once again, that was my conversation with Alex Mifflin. Season 5 of The Water Brothers is out now on TVO and available to stream on YouTube. Well, from a world of water to an island in water. Prince Edward Island, to be specific. The smallest province in Canada, but one with a lot of history. And you know, culturally, when, you know, we think of Atlantic Canada and sort of Atlantic Canada-isms in the Maritimes, we often go to, you know, Newfoundland and their sort of vernacular and language and culture and Nova Scotia. Prince Edward Island often gets left out and left behind. And filmmaker Jeremy Larder wants to change that. He is the writer-director of a hilarious new black comedy called Who's Your Father? And Yer, that's Y-E-R, which is quite a common greeting in Prince Edward Island, especially some of the smaller towns, when you say your name and you go, oh yeah, who's your father? Oh yeah, I know him. So that's where this saying comes from. And it follows a small-town PI, the only one on the island who kind of gets wrapped up in a game of, you know, deceit, lies, love triangles galore. It stars Susan Kent, who many Canadians might know from This Hour Has 22 Minutes, and comedian Chris Locke, and it is written and directed by Jeremy Larder, and this was my conversation with Jeremy. Hey, Jeremy, how's it going?
Good, Dan. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Just trying to avoid, it's getting slightly windy over here on the West Coast, but you know.
Oh yeah. So are you in BC?
Yeah, Victoria.
Oh, nice. I've never been out there.
It's nice. I mean, I only live here part of the year now, but you know, we like it over here.
Yeah. And where do you live the rest of the year?
UK.
Oh, nice. Whereabouts?
I'm kind of a bit all over. Like, I was in London this summer. I'm up north for next month, but looking at settling in like Glasgow kind of area.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
My wife's from the UK.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. No, I have a dual citizen, so it's nice for people to go back and forth when you can without any sort of restrictions.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. I still haven't been over there yet. But I'm really dying to go over there.
Yeah. So you have this new film, Who's Your Father?
Yes.
Which and you're spelled Y-E-R, we should point that out. Yeah. And I take it this is sort of an island saying to try to get to know who somebody is. They'll just ask who's your father? Is that right?
That's absolutely right. That's bang on. That's exactly what it is. And it comes up a lot. And even when you run into people, like I actually on my way back, flying from Halifax to Ottawa, talking to the people who worked at Air Canada, we got into a "Who's Your Father?" conversation, you know, and we figured out that we knew people who lived in the same community, really close to where I grew up.
Is that just a product of, you know, I mean, Prince Edward Island is small enough as it is, but I guess in the really small communities, it's sort of a way. It's like, oh yeah, you're so and so's kid. I know who you are, or I looked after you when you were a baby, that sort of thing.
Yeah, totally. And one time it actually got us out of a hairy situation when we were shooting the second season of my show, Just Passing Through. We were on this road that led to a wharf, and we had a sign up that said Bumblefuck, which was supposed to be the name of the town that these two guys were from in PEI.
Right.
And a fisherman didn't take too kindly to seeing that sign. You know, I had worked in that area. I had worked at that wharf. Anyway, then he got out of his truck. We had two motorized lazy boys driving down this road and with this sign up. And anyway, we got into a who's your mother conversation, and that diffused it pretty quickly.
You know, in when you look at Canadian cinema, you know, obviously there are shows shot in Vancouver where it never plays Vancouver. We see Toronto, you know, Quebec its own thing. We see Newfoundland. We don't really see PEI either portrayed too much on camera or even, you know, stuff shot there. Is it just that there aren't enough artists coming out of PEI or why do you think we ha PEI hasn't maybe quite had the opportunity to make that leap yet?
Well, I think it's probably a couple of things. One would be something you just touched on. It's a small population. Like right now, there's 150,000 people. When I was growing up there, there's 120,000 people. So just per capita, the amount of filmmakers that would come out of a place like that would be small. And two, there hasn't really been a lot of funding in place over the years historically for film in PEI. Now that's changed recently. The government's back on board with like a labor rebate and different programs, so that makes a big difference. And I think it's just like, you know, PEI is like fairly removed from the action in Toronto and in Vancouver, so it's not really close to a film center. Halifax is the closest one, so I think it's a product of those two things, and it takes time. And no one in the East Coast, well, in PEI, really has connections to the film industry. So you're kind of starting from scratch, you know, to build your way up. And I've been working at it now, I would say, for like 15 to 20 years as a filmmaker. Now I'm just getting my first feature in a theater. So it just takes time. But now there's like another generation of filmmakers who are way further ahead than I was at that age. So now I think that's going to change in the next few years.
But it also strikes me, it's a place that looks very beautiful on camera. It has a lot of sort of net, like similar to Victoria, has a lot of natural sort of beauty. Does that come across in film at all, do you think?
Oh, I think so for sure. I mean, you know, the adaptation of Anne of Green Gables from the 1980s was the one that I grew up with, and I don't know if any of that was actually shot on PEI, unfortunately. But it does offer like a very breathtaking landscape. It does look very PEI. I will say that, like, so it's you know, it's not really like a great place to like try to mimic New England or some other place because it's so distinctly Prince Edward Island. And I think that makes it a challenge for outside productions coming to the island to try to replicate something else. So if you're going to come to PEI to make a movie, you probably want to make a PEI story.
Well, I think Who's Your Father is a very PEI story in that it deals with let's call it black market lobster heists or lobster selling, if you will. I mean, lobster is a very, very East Coast thing. But to set it around seafood, where did that idea germinate from?
Well, that idea in particular about the black market lobster sales actually comes from my experience working as a lobster fisherman for a summer in PEI. And I also worked the wharf that's in the film, the Cove Head Wharf. I actually worked at that wharf as well. So, you know, unofficially or officially, I saw some things that involved black market lobster sales. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing that was happening in the backwoods of PEI. I didn't really know that was going on until I kind of witnessed some of it myself. So I've been like in with that lobster culture for a long time. I grew up 10 minutes away from there where that wharf is. So it just seemed like an interesting angle to a crime story, especially as to set a detective off onto a journey to investigate something that I hadn't seen in a film before.
No, I know you initially wrote this script almost 10 years ago in like 2014, 2015, and then I know you went and made off other projects. Why was now the right time for you to do this?
Well, the first version of the script was basically a ripoff of the 1945 film Detour. I saw that film. It's a very low budget film. It's actually on YouTube, but it's kind of like a classic noir in some ways. And I basically was just trying to do a very straight film noir. And then I set it aside to make other projects, like you mentioned. And then coming back to it in 2020, it started to shape more into a comedy. And I had been really interested in Private Investigation at that time, is trying to get like a side hustle to make some extra cash. So there was a 1 week course that was advertised in Ontario. Now, I never actually took it, but the idea that you could train for a week and become a private investigator was funny to me. And then I called a private investigator in PEI, the only one that was listed in Google, and called the guy and asked him, like, you know, so what's it like being a private eye in PEI? Like, it must be really hard because everybody knows everybody. And he's like, yeah, he was totally disgruntled. And he was about to quit. He was like, he was on the verge of quitting because he just couldn't handle like all his family members asking to spy on each other. So that seemed like a funny premise. And then there's a convenience store character that entered into the story there. And I had worked with Susan Kent on a project called Wharf Rats a few years before. I was just kind of helping my friends Jason and Jenna, who produced Who's Your Father, like work on this one. And I met Sue and saw her in person. I knew her from 22 Minutes. But just to see her up close and to see how dynamic she is and how brilliant she is as an actor and a comedian made me want to write the role for her. So I rewrote my script with Susan in mind to play that character. And then this private eye worked its way in, and it became just like an outrageous screwball comedy all of a sudden.
Is that always a challenge as a writer when you're writing a character, but you're doing it for a specific person? How does that affect the process, if at all?
I like it. I mean, it helps me because I could see and hear Sue the whole time that I was writing it. So it just gave me a place where it's like I knew who this character was. I could see their physicality. I could hear the voice. So for me, it was great. It was easier for me to write Rhonda in that way. Larry was different. Like, I didn't have Larry. I knew who I wanted Larry to be basically, but I couldn't see or hear Larry as clearly as I could hear Rhonda. So it's a different challenge, but I think, I don't know, like, I would keep doing it. Actually, now that I've worked with these actors on this film, I'm probably going to be writing for them in other projects too.
The characters in this film are so over the top in terms of their actions and how they speak, which can always be a tricky thing to do, especially on camera. I heard Ben Kingsley say once that the camera is allergic to acting. So it's a very kind of, it can be a balance to get there. How do you get actors to you know, go so far, especially when, as directors, you always want to say, okay, bring it down a little, bring it down a little, bring it down a little.
Right. Well, it's an interesting challenge. Like, in terms of the PEI-isms, it's actually like quite downplayed. I mean, I think people who aren't from the East Coast think that it's like so outrageous and so over the top, but like the accents and stuff is actually like on the low end. Like, it goes way, way beyond that. But just in terms of like the bigness of the performance, it's like, I really love like old screwball comedy and the absurdity of things. So I think the trick, because Chris and Sue are just so dynamic as performers and they have such great, they each have such individual physicality. I really want them to cut loose, but I think grounding the film with the love story and staying very truthful to that, you know, and treating that very kind of tenderly and delicately and like as if it's like a real thing, I think staying true to that allows the film to kind of be more outrageous and absurd and over the top, maybe in other ways, because the love story feels real, hopefully. And I think people are invested, the audience is invested in those two characters. So it allows you to kind of go wild in other places.
You know, given Chris and Sue's sort of background in comedy, how much was stuck to the script and how much did improv play a role in the filming?
Well, Chris and Sue and I, once Chris was cast, Sue said yes first. So Sue was the first actor that was cast. Then Chris auditioned and then they chemistry tested together. And then it was clear instantly that the two of them just had like a little bit of there's magic with them together. So we were doing Zoom calls leading up to production for months where we'd work through the script, talk through the script. We'd come up with different ideas for things. Every scene in the movie was made better by things that we discovered on the day or leading up to production. Like in those Zoom calls that Chris and Sue and I had together, we'd come up with things, or on the day, Steve Lund or Dio or Jess or someone would come up with something that just made the script better. So I would say that there isn't a scene in the film that doesn't have some element of spontaneity or improv that was created when we shot it.
You mentioned the PEI isms, and for people who sort of aren't from that area, how different is PEI from, let's say, Newfoundland or Nova Scotia in terms of its, like, Atlantic coast sensibilities?
Well, it's hard to say. They are different. They are distinctly different. But even within PEI, like different areas of the island are quite different. Like the west end of the island versus the east end of the island versus Charlottetown. Even that in the North Shore where I grew up, like the accents are different. It's like some parts of PEI sound more Newfoundland than they do PEI even. Like Hoosier, like everyone from Newfoundland always says it should be Hoosier fader, like FADDER. They're always like telling me it's spelled wrong. That'd be going next level with the title. But there's definitely crossover between all those places. But I think it's really where you come from. I think like the fishing communities across Atlantic Canada are all probably fairly similar with some, slight differences and thicknesses of accents. But I think like the general sweetness of Atlantic Canadians is kind of there across the board.
So why do you think is it that small towns can make for such good storytelling, whether it's drama or horror or comedy? What is it about small town life?
Well, I think for one, it's always like fairly cinematic. You're in open spaces often, when you're talking about rural settings or small town settings. I think there's a lack of pretension about small town places where like sometimes things are put together in ways that weren't meant to be put together. Like in the way the buildings look or the way that the like signs look is like so unpretentious and not really fussed over. There's something kind of beautiful, magical about that. And there's a certain innocence to a small town or a country place, we think. Now, it's not always like that. And then the question is, like, what's there beneath the surface? So I think that's, it feels like there's more ways, for me, it feels like there's more ways in to a story when it's in a small place.
And on that note, because he is a PI, what makes us interested in the lives of others?
Well, in PEI, sometimes it's maybe a little bit out of boredom, but I think like on the island, it really is a thing. I think it's not really out of boredom. That's not fair to say. I think it's like everyone is invested in like the lives of everyone else around them because they're so tied together in some way. And I think we're always sort of curious about what's going on under the surface, and what's kind of like lurking around the corner in some way. And I think in a small place, because there's fewer of you, you can get whispers of that a little bit more easy than you could in a bigger city. But yeah, I mean, people are just damn funny, and our choices, even the smartest of people make the dumbest decisions. So I think like humans are just endlessly fascinating that way.
So, in the process of making the film, did you have a favorite scene or a favorite moment that occurred?
Like while we were shooting it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the climactic motel scene, I love so much. I love to watch that one over and over and over again. I mean, it was really hard to do. That was a really big day that we had that day. Like, Sue had to do a lot, I think. But some of my favorite moments in the film, I love the comedy, obviously, but like, are the tender, quiet moments with Chris and Sue sitting in the van together and just watching two people in their 40s kind of like getting to know each other and seeing how sweet and vulnerable Chris is, and like their first kiss outside the store was really, really something sweet. But every day making the film with the actors and the crew, it was really special. It felt like summer camp most days. That's the way Chris describes it too. Like, it was just a joy, and we had like really incredible weather, and we just got lucky with a lot of things, and people were so kind to us. So you just don't know how often you're going to make a film. It might be 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the road. So I've learned to try to really appreciate being in the moment and having fun doing it. The store scenes were really fun because they felt easy compared to a lot of the other stuff we were doing. So the store was like, woo, we're in the store.
Can
We're not
relax
outside.
now.
Yeah, relax a little bit.
One of my favorite scenes is when Rhonda is giving directions to the daughter, and she goes, "Okay, well, you go up the road to where the blue house used to be, and then you go find the potato farm." How island is that? Because coming from a city, we're just like, oh yeah, you have to turn onto this street, and then you go, 4 blocks down this way. We're sort of not used to just doing it by, landmarks.
That's very common. That happens all the time. That's the way I give directions when I'm on PEI. And what Sue does in that scene where she, the first landmark she gives is a landmark that's not there anymore. I think it's like the blue house that burnt down. That happens all the time too. It's just a normal, I don't think I knew what the road numbers were on PEI until I was like in my 30s. Seriously, it's just like that's basically how you give directions on the island. I think it's a definitely a peculiarity that belongs to PEI.
You mentioned that the government's now sort of getting back to providing, like labor cuts and tax cuts and all that. What do you make of the state of film in PEI and then Canada as a whole?
Well, I think at PEI, I grew up with like a few different filmmakers that were about my age. I'm 44 now, so like Milla Clarks, who's a documentarian, my friend Adam Perry, who had a movie, A Small Fortune, come out a couple of years ago that Jenna also produced. I think, and there's also like a ton of people right now in their 20s on the island who are making really ambitious, great stuff. They're going to be really great in 5 to 10 years and are going to be making cool things. So I think it's where things are going is awesome. They just had a really great film festival there this year as well that Jenna and a bunch of friends produced. So that's great. In terms of Canada, I think that Telefilm has made a bunch of really great changes to their funding model and are giving more young filmmakers and new filmmakers a chance and a wider range of storytellers, which is really great. Even at low budget levels, it's really good to see. And this year, I think there's been a ton of really good Canadian films come out, like at the film festivals. Like if you look at last year compared to this year, it seems like, I don't know if it's because like there was COVID had something to do with last year, but there's just a ton of really good movies. I don't know how much you've been watching like the film festival circuits, but like it's just really impressive how many good films from Canada are coming out. So I think that giving more filmmakers a chance is going to completely change the landscape in Canada.
How do you think the pandemic not only changed the nature of how we make films, but also how we appreciate film?
Well, I know it definitely changed our appreciation for film because it definitely, as far as I know, even for myself personally, I think it lessened it. And I think we have to kind of relearn that to appreciate film, movies as an art form and as entertainment, but that it's like something that's important and shouldn't be taken for granted. And it's not just something that you pass out to on your couch every night at 9 o'clock. Not that I do that. I mean, maybe I do a little bit. But I have a young kid, so I just started going back to the theater again to watch movies that weren't kids' movies. And every movie is better on a big screen. And I think going back to the theater is important. Like having my movie in a theater in like in multiple cities is such a luxury and feels like such a privilege. I feel very fortunate and like feeling the audience and like a full crowd like laughing and watching a movie together is so beautiful. And I wish Cineplex and other people would talk more about how like every movie is great in the theater, instead of just saying like, oh, you got to see Dune in the theater because it's an epic, but like a beautiful like film that has like emotion and faces that are you like that's really important too. And you don't that theatrical experience is for every film. So I just hope more people start going back to the movies. And appreciating them for what they are. And like obviously some filmmakers like Scorsese and Nolan and Tarantino are really pushing that too. And I do think it's true. We kind of have to relearn that, I think, that movies are special, not disposable.
It's interesting you mentioned theaters because there's been this tug of war between theaters and streamers for a while, and like Cannes Film Festival essentially banned Netflix from the festival in terms of the French laws, and now streamers are introducing ads, which is kind of ironic, I think a little bit. What do you make of the discourse that we're having between these sort of competing forms of release?
Well, I mean, I don't know too much of the details of the discourse, but I mean, just for me, like, I thought the model that they had before was actually a pretty great model, where a movie would come in theaters, it would play for a few months, there'd be a bit of a gap, then it would come out on DVD or, something like that, like a home release. That seemed like a really good system, a really good model, because you got the theaters, people got the theatrical experience, and if they liked the movie enough, then they would buy the movie. So they kind of like just like destroyed their own model for how things were working pretty well. I mean, there's a place for all of it. I think people, we just don't know how things are going to shift. I think people are going to get sick of it at some point, the way people seem to be tiring of superhero movies a little bit. I mean, watching stuff at home is great. There's obviously a huge place for it, and we need to watch stuff at home, but it seems like they should be mutually compatible, and seems like it would also benefit the streamers to also have their movies in the theater, because it builds more buzz and gets people more excited for them to watch them at home. So there are a lot of very rich people involved. So I'm sure they'll be able to sort it out, all in the name of commerce.
As an independent filmmaker, does market saturation worry you at all?
Not really. It's just like, I'm from PEI, so the movie right now in PEI is just like people are going nuts for it. Like, it's selling out like multiple shows a day. So we have like this interesting niche of like of an island that's really wanting to watch this movie, like it's Barbie or Titanic, essentially. So that's really cool. It's just hard, like when you're a needle in a haystack, like in Toronto or like on a streaming service, it's like, how do you separate yourself and make yourself stand out? So I think you just have to have faith in what you're making and just trust that what you're doing. Like, when I make something, I want people who like it to love it. Like, not everyone's gonna like it. Some people might hate it. That's fine. I just want the people who like the movie to really love the movie so much that it's their favorite thing in the world. So I think if you think of it like that what you're make you want to make something that's gonna capture people so much. Some people are gonna hate it. That's fine. But if you want to capture those people, then I think you're gonna be okay.
Do you find that it's been getting a good reception, at least among Islanders?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it seems like, yeah, among Islanders, and like we toured the film. We like Susan, Chris, and I went on a little East Coast tour with Allie. We went to Moncton with the movie in St. John, and it's amazing to see the crowd, like literally people from 13 to 85. My 93-year-old grandmother went to see the movie, which is like a little bit horrified in some ways, as you can imagine. But it is cool to see like how, like, even though there is like, there's some raunchy stuff in the movie and some swearing, it does seem like the heart of the film resonates with people from like quite young to old. So that's really lovely to see. And, even if it was just people in PEI that loved it, it would mean a lot to me. But I think it really does have a broad appeal that can go transcend the East Coast and go across the country, hopefully.
Is there maybe, I don't know, one message or one thing that you want audiences who see this film to take from it?
That's a good question. I think part of it, when I started rewriting the script, it was sort of like after like I got my life kind of back on track after like it kind of like going into shambles for a period of time after I made Pogie Beach, and then I met my partner shortly after that. So that's why I wanted to make it a love story, especially. I think it like part of it is like, just because you're in your 40s, or no matter where you are in your life, like things can change in a heartbeat, and you never know what's around the corner, and something like the best thing that ever could happen to you could be around the corner. So, just try to keep your chin up and just stay hopeful.
And finally, where is the best place in PEI to get chowder?
Chowder. Now, I'll say one place for sure. There's going to be people in PEI scream at me, probably for getting it wrong, but I hear Blue Mussel Cafe in North Rustico supposed to have the best chowder on the island. I've heard. I'm not saying it's the truth. It's just what I heard.
All right, well, Blue Mussel Cafe, anybody out there in PEI, you may be listening, and we'll write to us and tell us how good it is. The film is Who's Your Father? And it is out in theaters across the country now. I do believe.
Yeah, it's just opening in Toronto on Friday, November 10th. And it's in Newfoundland and Sydney and Summerside as well. So hopefully the movie keeps going further west.
Well, it's a great film. I encourage all the listeners to check it out. Jeremy Larder, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Dan. It was a pleasure to meet
Cheers.
you.
And once again, that was my conversation with Jeremy Larder. His film, Who's Your Father, is in limited release as of November the 10th. That does it for me today. My thanks to Jeremy Larder, and my thanks to Alex Mifflin of The Water Brothers, now available out on TVO and YouTube. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and I will see you next time. Bye for now.